This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. If you hope the midterms would reset the political dialogue, forget it. In the 6 days since the polls closed, charges about fraud, vote stealing, and suppression have filled the vacuum left by the negative campaign ads that have gone off the air. On Wednesday, President Trump claimed a great victory, then intensified his attacks on the press, called for new elections in Arizona. When his candidate fell behind and dismissed the attorney general, forcing special counsel Robert Mueller to report to someone who has made it clear he thinks the investigation is unwarranted. For insight on how to wrap up the midterms and what they reveal about American politics going forward, we are joined today by WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson and political junkie Ken Rudin, who, by the way, is about to celebrate a major birthday somewhere in his 40s, I think. Ken, Howard, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you. And it's not a major birthday, okay? And you say my 40s, you don't mean the 1940s. No, neither one is correct. Yeah. It's not a major birthday. It just so happens. That,
yeah. Well, Ken, when I actually met you in person 2 weeks ago for the first time, my reaction was, he's so much younger than I thought he was. So, you know, who knows?
So, that's because you work every day with Howard. So, you know, I understand that.
There you go. Ken, do you have a trivia question to get us started and to stump Howard again?
I do. So Mike DeWine he was elected governor of Ohio on Tuesday. 50.7% of the vote he got against Richard Cordray. Who was the most recent Ohio governor who was elected with a smaller percentage than DeWine's 50.7?
So the most recent one with a smaller percentage. Okay. All right. If you think you know the answer to that question, call 513-382-9263. And if you also want to join the conversation, call us at that number or email us at talk@wvxu.org. So just to get started here, Howard, the president declared on the day after the midterm elections that Republicans achieved, quote, close to a complete victory. Nancy Pelosi that same day declared victory for the Democrats and restoration of checks and balances on President Trump. Who's right?
Neither one of them, actually. They're not entirely right. They're partially right. I mean, you know, there was a victory in that they managed, the Republicans kept the Senate, although we kind of expected that. And what we also expected was the Democrats would take over the House, and they have done that. Now, what that means in terms of Trump and his presidency going forward, it's still unclear. How far will, Nancy Pelosi, assuming she's Speaker, will she take this new power that the Democrats have in the House? Because they don't have it, obviously, in the Senate.
They don't have it in the Senate. But that Senate is still pretty tight.
Sure.
It's still very tight. Yeah. Ken, how would you agree with Howard that from an overall point of view, that's kind of where you would put the results to?
I would have agreed the day after the election. On Wednesday morning, even Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, I thought, well, you know what? It's a mixed bag. The Democrats won the House, as we predicted. The Republicans gained the Senate, as we predicted. But in the succeeding days, in the intervening days from then until now, with more and more returns coming in, it feels like it is a good night, was a good night, or a good week, I should say, too, because we keep getting more and more results for the Democrats. Not only did they gain about 32 House seats as of this counting, a number that could increase to 35, 36, maybe close to 40, that would be the biggest, it already is the largest increase in House seats for the Democrats since 1974, the year of the Watergate midterm election, when Richard Nixon was at his nadir and had just resigned. So I think it was a very good year, a very good election for the Democrats, picked up more House seats than I expected, did well in California, picked up seats that nobody saw coming in South Carolina and Oklahoma and elsewhere. And you know something? Yes, the Republicans did pick gain in the Senate, and yes, they were expected to gain in the Senate, given the fact that 28 of the 35 Senate seats, 26 of the 35 Senate seats were already Democratic, but the Democrats still picked up,
Already Republican, right? Oh, no, Democratic. You're right. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. That's okay, but I'm saying, but the Democrats also picked up Senate seats in Nevada. It looks like with her 32,000 vote lead as of now, Kyrsten Sinema has a lead in Arizona, which was Jeff Flake's seat. So they could get two seats there, which would give the Republicans a net gain of two. Now, that's not something to dismiss, given the fact that Trump, their own party's president, is in the White House. But given the numbers that were at stake, I think I would say it was a – and also the Democrats picked up a net gain of seven gubernatorial seats. So I would say all in all, look, there were disappointments for the Democrats, disappointment for the Republicans. I think it was a good night for the Democratic Party.
I think there were some good signs for the future for the Democrats, too, in that a lot of those races were decided by suburban voters. And that's suburban voters who voted Democratic, some of them for the first time. And if that is a trend, then the Republican Party is going to have some trouble. Mitch McConnell acknowledged that today.
Yeah. And because traditionally, better educated, college educated, advanced degrees educated people historically had voted Republican. At least in this election, seems to be shifting. And I'd like to raise the question, how do you pair that also not only with women's votes, but women running for office in Congress? Big shift there, new wave here, right, Ken?
Well, yes, absolutely. We saw a record number of women running. We also saw a record number of women winning, especially in the House. There will be more than 100 female members of the House in the new Congress, which is, an all-time record. Now we're talking with the 435 members. We're still talking about less than 25%, which is hardly indicative of what their, what their situation is with the population at large. But still, it's we always talk about the year of the woman, and they do increase. But they did pick up a record number of House seats. They're tied with the largest now seats and a number of seats in the Senate. They gained in governor's races around there. But you know something? One place that was not the year of the woman clearly was Ohio. They did not pick up any new House seats. Matter of fact, Ohio hasn't changed its House delegation since 2012, which is a long time. And none of that, statewide races did a woman win.
Well, and so I might also say, in our region generally, looking large, Amy McGrath lost in Kentucky as well.
She ran a very
good race.
Came close.
She's a good candidate, but Andy Barr won and kept that seat, and that was the only thing worth watching in Kentucky. That was the one that was one of the first returns, and when Amy McGrath had a lead early, everybody was saying, "Oh my goodness, the Democrats are going to have an amazing night." And then when Andy Barr won, we said, "Well, maybe the Republicans will have a good night." But as it turned out, both were very good candidates.
Yeah, and Ken, you're exactly right about Ohio at large and the women candidates who are running. But if you go down to our level, to the county level in Hamilton County, they just tore everybody up. I mean, women won judgeships, women won
county commission.
Right. They won everything.
Yep. I want to raise the question with the House of Representatives. There's the question of the future of Nancy Pelosi. Is Nancy Pelosi, Ken, is she locked in to return as Speaker? There were people who ran saying they would not vote for her. What's going to happen here?
I'm more confident of Pelosi becoming Speaker now than I was a week ago. You're absolutely right. There was no shortage of Democratic candidates around the country who pledged they would not vote for Nancy Pelosi for another term as Speaker. She is 78 years old. She's been heading the Democrats in the House for 15 years, which includes two devastating defeats in 2010 and 2014. And so but how do you toss out somebody who just brought the Democrats back to the promised land with, again, the best showing in the House for them since biggest pickup since 1974. So yes, there are a lot of people who are not happy with Pelosi. They want new, more vibrant, more a younger leadership. But nobody has stepped forward yet. Nobody has said, I'm challenging her. And for all those Democrats, including Tim Ryan of Ohio and others who said that we need a change, they're not. Nobody seems to be rallying around anybody. It could change, and maybe there will be a challenge coming up. But right now, I don't see the kind of challenge that I expected maybe a week or two ago.
Yeah, I think a lot of it was just campaign talk. And it's the kind of thing that they, you know, immediately forget.
Well,
once the ballots are counted.
Here's a question on my mind. Should the Democrats not be able to generate in the caucus, in their caucus, a majority for Pelosi? Is there a possibility some Republicans would come over, vote for Pelosi to make her speaker so that the Republicans can run against Pelosi and a Pelosi-led House in 2020?
Well, I kind of like that. I mean, that has never happened. That has happened in state legislatures. I remember there was a famous New York race years and years ago where Democrats joined with dissident Democrats, Republicans joined with dissident Democrats to come up with a speaker that nobody expected. But no, I don't expect that, because you know that no matter who is Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi or Nancy and Sluggo, I mean, anybody could, you know. But the fact is, the House will be a target for Donald Trump. You know that he can't live without targets, without enemies. It was very remarkable, I thought, that the day after the election, in that unbelievably surreal news conference that Trump had, he listed all the Republicans who lost in the House and said they lost because they weren't loyal to him. They didn't, you know, latch on to him. And he said, like he said, Mike Kaufman of Colorado, so long, Mike, or too bad, Mike. Yeah. Mia Love of Utah didn't give me love. I mean, he named all the Republicans he had such disdain for because they didn't embrace him. So you know that he loves to focus on people. He attacked Jeff Flake on Wednesday, saying basically good riddance. You know there's not going to be a shortage of attacks coming from the president on a Democratic-controlled House, no matter whether it's Nancy Pelosi or anybody else.
Howard, have you ever seen anything like that that part of that press conference before?
No, I have not. And on the other hand, then he took credit for every Republican who did win. And to a certain extent, he was telling the truth. I think, you know, like in Mike DeWine's case, I think that big rally he had the day before in Cleveland, I think that helped convince a lot of the Trump voters to go with him.
Well, we're going to have to take a break. So, Ken, can you give us the trivia question one more time? And there's an open field right now for answering this question.
Mike DeWine was elected governor of Ohio on Tuesday with 50.7% of the vote. Who is the most recent Ohio governor elected with a smaller percentage?
Aha. On election night, seven journalists from our sister city, Kharkiv, Ukraine, spent over an hour at the Hamilton County Board of Elections quizzing me and others about American election procedures. They and many citizens of nations caught between democratic ideals and dictatorial instincts have little faith in voting. Given controversies about voter suppression, the fights over vote counting, undermine confidence of U.S. citizens in voting, and ultimately, it may undermine confidence in democracy itself. For insight into the implications of the votes in the election process, we're joined today by political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. Now, we do have people who just lit up our screens before, and we'll get to those in a minute because I want to allow our Pete Reitmeier, our producer, to catch up with what was going on since I passed out the wrong telephone number. So if you think you know the answer to Ken's trivia question, and Ken, real quick, short form, give us your question one last time.
The question is, what is Dan Hurley's home telephone number?
No.
Mike DeWine won on Tuesday with 50.7% of the vote. Who's the most recent Ohio governor who won by a smaller percentage?
Okay. And we'll give it a couple seconds and a couple minutes here while people log in with their answers, and then we'll get to the answer on that one. So
Looking at all the controversies about counting the votes that have emerged since election night, here we are back in Florida again with ballots stacked up. Arizona has been slow but steady in terms of reporting results, although there's been some questions raised by the president. What do you say about this tabulation process that we live with in the United States?
Well, you know something, it seems like we have not learned, or at least I should say Florida has not learned from the debacle of 2000, when basically you have 99, whatever, how many counties you have, and every county in Florida has its own way of counting the votes. They have their own, its own way of designing the ballot. So what's happening in Florida is not too dissimilar from not the hanging chad and the and all the craziness that went on in 2000, the famous Gore versus Bush, or should I say Bush versus Gore election in 2000, with so many people mistakenly voting for Pat Buchanan and Ralph Nader getting, you know, enough votes to give the state to George W. Bush. But it still happened again in Florida, in the fact that we still have a race for governor, which is very, very close. We have a race for the Senate very close. In the Senate race, Rick Scott, who is the outgoing governor, is leading Senator Bill Nelson by 12,562 votes. That is 0.15% of a difference. And in the governor's race between Rick DeSantis and Andrew Gillum, it's also very, very close. It's 0.41% difference. So, you know, there's a lot of focus on what's going on in Broward County. President Trump, Marco Rubio, and others have tweeted that the Democrats are coming up with fake votes, that they have baskets and boxes of votes that they're springing on the count, you know, at the last second. A lot of that has been proven to be complete nonsense. But having said that, there are irregularities. There are things that don't look right. And I don't know if it's an incompetent board of elections at Broward County, which basically is very Democratic. It's like Fort Lauderdale, just, you know, north of Miami. But it's also it's not giving people confidence whether their vote counted. And I took a look at the Broward County ballot this morning, and basically the battle for governor, or should I say for the Senate, is way down. It's nowhere. It's after all the ballot questions, and so a lot of people didn't even vote for governor or senator in Broward County. So there are just a lot of mistakes being made. It's not the right way to do it, and again, it doesn't feel like we've learned much from 2000.
No, I agree. I mean, it's astounding to me that 18 years later, Florida is still having these problems when immediately after that happened, states like Ohio and many others spent millions and millions and millions of dollars to fix their systems so that every county was voting and tabulating in the same manner. And we do that now, and we don't have these kind of problems.
You know, and I just want to say one quick thing, that for all the fears about Russian involvement and Russian interference, yeah. I did not see much or any evidence of that around the country. And, you know, there were fears like they hacked into the Illinois system a few months ago. But I see no evidence of fraudulent votes or any outside tampering.
Right.
You know, one thing I do want to say is it sometimes strikes me, having worked for television, where it, you know, we expect results on everything to be instantaneous almost. It's a culture that lives online where Google gives us answers in split seconds. And the point is, a lot of these processes are set up to last 10 days. You can't do the final vote. You can't make the final decision and wrap everything up for 10 days because there's votes that have to come in from overseas. There's military votes,
provisional ballots,
and people have lost patience. And as a television reporter, you know, the producers are always calling and saying, we want more results. We want more results. And the point is, on election night, there aren't any results yet. It takes time to make this happen. And I think we have to recalibrate and help people understand what the process is.
But some states did clearly better than others. There are some states that were reported very efficiently, and there are some who I think they use an abacus and see how the vote is coming in and are notoriously slow.
Okay. We're going to get to the question about who won the Ohio election most recently with a smaller percentage of votes than did Mike DeWine on Tuesday. So we're going to start with Brian. Brian, what is your answer?
Ted Strickland.
Ted Strickland. Ken, what do you think?
Well, when Ted Strickland beat, I think he beat Ken Blackwell, it was by a larger percentage. Matter of fact, it wasn't even a close election.
Very large.
So Ted Strickland is not the correct answer.
Okay. And then our next person is Michael.
How about Bob Taft?
Bob Taft. I mean, Bob Taft was controversial. Okay, some close issues.
This may give away the answer, but Bob Taft did win his election in 1998 by a smaller percentage than Mike DeWine, but he's not the most recent.
Aha, not the most recent. Ah. An important part of that. And Connie has the same. She's next up, but Connie also has Bob Taft. So I'm going to go to.
We don't hear Connie's voice, do we?
Okay. Connie, do you understand why I'm skipping over you? I think she's gone. So, Teresa, what's your guess? Teresa?
Oh, yeah. Well, mine's way before then. I was thinking in the 1970s that Rhodes won over Gilligan.
Yeah, I can assure you that Ken's old enough that he can remember that, but
right. Dan, that was yesterday. But let me just say one thing about Teresa. That is that Rhodes over Gilligan in 1974 was the closest Ohio's governor's race in our lifetime. So I would give Teresa a prize, not because it's the correct answer, but it was the closest in history.
11,000 votes.
Yep, it was. He got 48.6% of the vote, Jim Rhodes, in 1974 in the big Watergate year. So I think Teresa gets honorable mention.
Yes. Pete's going to make sure that takes place. And our final person who has thinks they have the answer, Brett. What is your answer?
I believe the answer is John Kasich over Ted Strickland in 2010.
Ken?
That is the correct answer. 49% of the vote.
So it was that most recent part that was absolutely critical into this.
I mean, Taft was a good answer, but not the most recent. And, yep, so it was John Kasich in 49%. And yet the reelection in 2014 was a landslide. Yeah. I mean, we could talk about why the Democrats didn't have a great candidate, but he went from under 50% to a landslide 4 years later.
Okay. All right. Getting back to we're going to check with Howard. Howard, did you have that right?
I did.
Howard had it right. Does not surprise us.
I was there. I was around 2010, yeah.
Wow, you remember?
Yeah.
Grandpa, you remember 2010?
I do.
Wow.
Just remember, you're having your birthday tomorrow, Ken. Okay. So,
what was Ted Strickland like? Oh, my God.
Yeah. All right. So, the other thing that came out of what you referred to, I think, Ken, as that amazing press conference the day after the election.
Oh, my God.
Was actually not in the press conference, but came out immediately after the press conference. And that was the announcement that the attorney general was resigning. And Jeff Sessions was out, and his note his letter of resignation made it clear that he had been asked to step aside. And Matthew Whitaker has been appointed. So all kinds of controversy around this appointment, this interim appointment, and one is around timing. Ken, what do you see in terms of the timing of this particular one?
Well, Dan, I hope you said you had quotation marks around the word resigning, because there's no question that Jeff Sessions was fired, forced out, and we knew that his term in office was not going to last that long. And I kind of think that by the House, by the Democrats winning the House on election night, basically Donald Trump realizes that you know, his complete control over the apparatus of power in government regarding the Mueller investigation could come to an end in the fact that the Democrats will now have subpoena power, investigative power, things like that. And so Sessions, he wanted out. He wanted an attorney general who might put some kind of a restriction on Mueller. And you know, Matthew Whitaker, as he said in commentary on CNN and elsewhere, he has complete contempt for the Mueller investigation. He calls it a witch hunt. He says it's just not right. And he also has contempt for the Supreme Court and the role of the judiciary. I mean, this guy is a true believer, and of course some Democrats are saying, wait a second, how does somebody like this, who has shown such complete contempt for this investigation, now be in charge of the investigation? Because now with Jeff Sessions no longer keeping himself out of the loop, Mitt Whitaker is now Robert Mueller's boss. So he could, he's not going to fire him, I don't think, but he can certainly say no to some of the requests, say no to some of the finances involved. And boy, the Democrats are not happy about this at all.
Well, Howard, on this timing question, the fact that Matthew Whitaker is now directly supervising Ken Mueller, Mueller's operation has been relatively quiet over the last few weeks leading up to the midterms, which is common.
Yeah.
And it was I think it was deliberate.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I don't think there's any doubt about it.
Yeah.
But, you know, Sessions wanted to stay until Friday, and he was told, no, you're out of there today, which was Wednesday.
Right.
So why what's the immediacy? What's the expectation about the next step here?
I don't know. I mean, it was odd today. Lindsey Graham came out for some reason and started saying that Whitaker, he doesn't want to interfere with what Mueller's doing at all. He was almost guaranteeing that he would not. How he knows that, I don't know, unless he expects to be the next, the permanent attorney general.
Ah.
Yeah, remember, Lindsey Graham last year said that if the president fires Jeff Sessions, you know, there'll be holy bloody hell to deal with. And now he's saying, it's okay.
It's not going to be. Yeah, it's not going to be a problem.
But Gerald Nadler, who's going to be the incoming chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, said that he wants to interview have Whitaker testify before his committee about what he plans to do with Mueller.
Yes.
And if he won't, he'll subpoena him. So the Democrats are not going to let this go very quietly. They're not going to let Whitaker have complete say over what's going on without a fight from the Democrats.
Well, you know, the thing about this is there's the timing question. There's the conflict of interest question, which both of you have raised. And there's also a question of constitutionality that we have to raise, which is whether or not, since Whitaker has never been through a Senate confirmation hearing, whether he can be a principal officer of the United States. Or vice versa, the question of whether the law under which he was appointed, Federal Vacancies Reform Act of 1998, there's questions that's never been tested in court, whether that's constitutional. So
and you know who's making that case, right? Kellyanne Conway's husband, George Conway, had an op-ed in the New York Times the other day. He said that anything that Whitaker does regarding Mueller would be unconstitutional, illegal, and, you know, just, I mean, he went ballistic on this. And so I would love to know what Kellyanne and George Conway have to say that night, you know, when they get home. But my goodness, Conway spared no indignation about the role that Whitaker could play and how wrong it was. So he was really on the warpath on that one.
On the other hand, Howard, by the time that the president was ready to leave for Europe, for Paris, he seemed not to know much about Whitaker.
No, he seemed to know nothing about Whitaker.
Who?
I mean, I don't think he could have picked him out of a lineup.
Well, that's what he was saying.
But yeah, we know that. Right. But we know that's not true.
I know.
We know that's not true.
I know. Yeah. Well, let's add that to the many other things that have been said that are not true.
So, and the possibility of, you know, once somebody has crossed this president,
right,
they don't last long.
No, no.
Even if they've
no.
been appointed by this They're, president. Yeah. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. The last week not only roiled domestic politics, but over the weekend it was clear just how much Europe and the United States are pulling against each other. To examine developments in international relations in the past 10 days, we are joined today by political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Ken, the speech that President Emmanuel Macron gave under the Arc de Triomphe yesterday and calling out the difference between nationalism and patriotism, with President Trump sitting, what, four seats away from him after he had declared himself a nationalist in recent rallies. This was pretty direct approach. It was not an attempt to try to be nice to the American president, but really calling him out in many ways. Ken?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a stunning rebuttal of what the president has been saying all along, that I'm not a globalist, I'm a nationalist. And of course, given the fact that nationalism and strong nationalism and even white nationalism is on the upswing in parts of Europe, in Hungary, in Poland, parts of Italy and elsewhere, with a lot of blowback against immigration and people of color coming into their countries, what Macron said was very, very fascinating. It's the fact is that Trump was already in bad stead with the fellow allies, given the fact that he failed to join in this march among these leaders, world leaders, on Sunday because it was raining. The president didn't go to an American cemetery on Saturday, but he did have time to have a nice chat with Vladimir Putin. So it was very interesting that among the U.S. allies that Trump has been denigrating and insulting for the past 2 years, and that's over, you know, climate change and trade and NATO and things like that, Macron did not hold back at all and said, look, there's a difference. I am a patriot. It's the exact opposite of nationalism. And not only was it a slight on what's going on in some of the slowly becoming autocratic countries of Eastern Europe, but definitely a shot at the president of the United States.
Howard, on Monday, today, when the president was back in the United States, he once again sort of hinted that the United States' commitment to NATO is right. Tenuous. What would be the practical implications of the United States pulling out of NATO?
It would pretty much destroy the coalition. I mean, you know, he is right about one thing. That's where the money comes from. And it just makes no sense. From the U.S.'s standpoint or from Europe's standpoint, we need each other in this. And he just doesn't seem to be capable of understanding that. This, you know, we go it alone philosophy. And it's unworkable in this world.
What people seem to forget, or what Trump seems to forget, is the purpose of NATO, the reason why NATO was created, was to stop World War III before it happens, right. To prevent World War III. And here we are celebrating or commemorating the 100th anniversary of the war that was supposed to end all wars, World War I, and the fact that he's still questioning alliances that have kept the peace, for the most part, you know, in the... What, 70 years since World War II? It's just remarkable that basically what he's doing is exactly what Putin wants. He's dividing the Western powers. He's dividing the U.S. allies. And who takes over? Who benefits? Russia and China.
What's the viability, Ken, if I ask Howard about NATO? Macron has floated the idea of a European army. How viable, practical is that? Trump, by the way, called it insulting.
Well, with, you know, I mean, we're still talking about more and more armies, more and more soldiers, more and more troops, more and more, and as opposed to talking more about more and more peace. So, look, I don't think Europe wants to go it alone. I think Trump would be very happy if the United States disengaged from Europe militarily because, you know, it's an America First policy. But it's, look, I think the reason the world has been safe, comparatively so, is because of American leadership, U.S. leadership, U.S. military strength. We've made our share of mistakes, shall we say, and our boneheaded decisions on foreign policy. But for the most part, you know, the world is not in flames like it was in the 40s or in the, you know, the early 1900s with World War I. So when, you know, when Europe, if Europe goes alone and everybody's on their own, it just, it leads to more and more insults and sore bad feelings and no worldwide leadership that could only lead to trouble.
I don't think Macron would even be talking about this if it wasn't for the fact that Donald Trump basically spits in their eye every time he goes over there.
Yeah. On a slightly different tact, not about high-level policy, President went there to mark the end of World War I on November the 11th, on yesterday, Sunday. On Saturday, he was scheduled to go to an American cemetery not far from Paris, especially if he could have traveled by helicopter, and decided not to go. And this has raised all sorts of issues. And I guess my question is, does he have people around him who are trying to tell him sort of the political side of the White House, trying to say, don't do that, we got to find an alternative, and he just doesn't pay attention? Or does he not have the people around him who are even making those advice?
Well, I think the reason that could very well be the case, just think of, let me just switch gears for one quick second. Think of his response to the horrific wildfires in California. I mean, at least 31, 32 people have been killed so far. Mm-hmm. So many people have lost their lives, their life savings and animals and homes and possessions and everything. And rather than be the empathizer in chief, as the president is supposed to do, as we saw after Oklahoma City, after 9/11, after countless gun murders around the country, the president tweets something like, you know, remedy now, there's gross mismanagement in the way we're managing the fires, I mean, the forest around the country, around the state, I'm sorry, in California. Remedy now or no more Fed payments, he tweets. It's about politics, and it becomes like, once again, I'm going to show you that I'm better than California. When one would think that this is screaming for some kind of an empathetic message from the president, and it never came.
It's just so tone deaf. I mean, it's absolutely tone deaf to what the American people need at certain times, you know, in times of tragedy like this. And going back to the American cemetery in France, that's just something a president does. It doesn't matter if it's raining. It doesn't matter if it's raining frogs. You go there and you talk, and you speak about the sacrifices that were made by Americans to help liberate Europeans.
Well, you know,
do you remember when Hillary Clinton had pneumonia and stumbled and was not doing well towards the end of the, and how the Trump campaign mocked her, even though she attended a ceremony or a campaign event, she was suffering from pneumonia and they mocked her mercilessly. And here it is, he can't go out in the rain on Saturday because it's raining. It's just tone. Howard said tone deaf. That's exactly what it is. It's just stunning in an administration that stunning no longer holds the word that used to hold.
You know, on another front, and that is our imposition of sanctions against Iran, juxtaposed to our relationships with Saudi Arabia, something that came out again over the weekend was that Erdogan, from the president of Turkey, made it clear that the tapes of Jamal Khashoggi's murder have been shared with the United States, with Great Britain, with France, with Saudi Arabia. And, you know, that's back on October 2nd. What do you think our policy really is in terms of how we're going to respond to Saudi Arabia, given on the one hand our need for oil, shutting down the uranium markets, and on the other hand our call and our historic call to stand up for human rights? Howard?
I'm not even sure there is going to be a response, Dan. I really don't. I mean, I see no sign of it. Like you said, this has been since October 2nd. It's a long time. And, you know, I think they just want this to go away.
Can it go away?
Well, that's the big question. I personally don't think it can, because there's enough people out in the world are going to keep it alive.
Ken, what do you think about all of this?
Well, I think we have the United States has given an answer, and the answer is we do not want to lose Saudi Arabia as a military ally, a buffer against Iran. Trump said it wasn't worth sacrificing the billions of dollars that Saudi Arabia would spend in American armaments, which is pretty remarkable, although that's not unusual in American history, doing military alliances over freedom back home. But for him to talk about, I don't want to sacrifice all these military, deals that I'm doing with Saudi Arabia, is our answer. And the fact that Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, is very close with the crown prince, I think it's no question that we have thrown our lot with Saudi Arabia. And I mean, is it short-sighted? Is it smart in the short term? Perhaps in the long term, it may be a disaster. But right now, that's what Trump is saying, and he's sticking with it.
So, however the two of you phrase it, Howard, you're saying they're going to let it go and hope it goes away.
Yeah, but there may be a price to pay.
And Ken saying they think the choice has been made. Both of you sort of agree that we're not going to take a stand on the Khashoggi assassination.
Right. Oh, he'll say all the nice things. He'll say it's a shame, and we need to find out. Right.
Okay.
Yeah, we need to punish those responsible. But it's just a lot of empty talk, and it's clear where his priority is when it comes to Saudi Arabia and its relationship with Washington.
I want to go back to election results for a little bit, because there's some things that we didn't get to, and that is on the question of gubernatorial races. There were some very important gubernatorial races, including here in Ohio, which, of course, the Republican nominee, Mike DeWine, won fairly decisively in the end. But putting sort of gubernatorial races and state legislatures in context, Ken, what do you see? Were there, because that's the grassroots. That sort of may be indicating the long run of what's happening. What did you see coming out of the elections from that?
Well, actually, we for all our talk about it, I said this when I was in there in Cincinnati with you, that for all our focus on governor, from Senate and House races, it's governors and state legislatures that will decide how the congressional districts are drawn after the 2020 census. And so the fact that Mike DeWine won in Ohio, that was a big victory. I spent a lot of this hour talking about how great the Democrats did on Tuesday, and they did, but Mike DeWine in Ohio is not to be dismissed. That was a big, big victory, especially in an election when not everybody was convinced how the state was going to go. But having said that, the Democrats did pick up 7 governorships, including big states like Michigan, Illinois, and Wisconsin. They knocked off Scott Walker, and that was a huge win. And given the fact that it was Wisconsin that basically was the ground zero of redistricting or partisan gerrymandering that started the process after the 2010 census, I mean, beating Scott Walker in Wisconsin, beating Kris Kobach in Kansas, who was not a fan of letting everybody vote, shall we say. So those were good victories for the Democrats. But again, having said that, and also the Democrats picked up 250 state legislative seats around the country, which pales in comparison to what the Republicans did in 2010. But given the fact that most of these state legislative races are in the lines drawn by Republicans, I think the Democrats, you know, had a nice night on Tuesday. Could they have done better? Do they wish they had done better? Yes. But it's a good start for them as they head into 2020.
Howard, that trend wasn't obvious in Ohio.
No. But it was in many other states. Ken's right about that. In Ohio, it was not. And just mainly because the Democrats only picked up a handful of seats in the Ohio House. They lost all of the other statewide constitutional offices, not just governor, but secretary of state, auditor, attorney general, and treasurer. And, you know, most of those offices have a hand in drawing district lines. And so that process, you know, for the time being, except for congressional district, you know, we have a constitutional amendment now.
It was just passed
in May. But as far as the state legislative districts, that's still totally in the hands of the Republicans.
So what about in Georgia, Ken? Where do you think we stand at this moment? And what do you expect to see sort of emerging out of Georgia in the long run? That was an awful lot of attention put on that.
Well, the reason, one of the two reasons why there was a lot of attention on Georgia is, one, that the Republican nominee for governor, Brian Kemp, is also the Secretary of State who decides basically who votes and who doesn't vote. And Stacey Abrams, the Democratic nominee, who happens to be African-American, she was head of a group that tried to get a lot of blacks to enroll and register for the first time. And the Secretary of State's office held up some 50,000-60,000 registration attempts, most of them by African-Americans, on the grounds that, you know, they may not have dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. So there was always controversy about Brian Kemp's role in the voting process in Georgia. Now, right now, I think he has a somewhat sizable lead of 59,000 votes over Stacey Abrams. That's Brian Kemp. But here's the thing. Right now, he has 50.28% of the vote. In Georgia, if you don't have a majority, you go to a runoff in the following month. That's always the case with Georgia governor's races. You need a majority to win. If you don't, it goes to a runoff. If Stacey Abrams could narrow the lead enough for Kemp to go under 50%, then you'll have, you know, a rematch basically in December. But right now, I don't see where the votes are for Abrams to overtake him. Her only hope really is to get him under 50%.
So taking something like Abrams, and Howard, we only have about 30 seconds, like Abrams or Beto O'Rourke in Texas, who maybe have lost. He definitely lost. Mm-hmm. Anything gained there? Anything that changes? Is there something good about losing sometimes?
Well, yeah. I mean, you got to get a toehold somewhere, and you got to build on it. And that's what I think is going to happen in both of those states.
Okay. So Georgia and Texas— interesting states to have those close races in. So I want to thank Ken Rudin, Howard Wilkinson for being here today for this midterm wrap-up, although not everything's wrapped up. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.